Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Thanks.
Thank you, Pat. Please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Steve will read the steps.
Steve, alcoholic? All right, step one, we admitted we are powerless over alcohol, that our lives have become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understand Him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, to another human being, the exact natures of our wrongs. Six, when entirely ready to have God remove all of these defects of character. Seven, humbly ask Him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we have harmed and become willing to make amends with them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continue to take personal inventory, and when we are wrong, promptly admit it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Thank you, Steve. The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers followed by the information break and then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Pat F.
Hey, how you doing? Pat, alcoholic. I had no idea this meeting was this big. I've never been here. I'm just like speaking in front of like 10 people. I'm an alcoholic. That's why I'm here on like a Thursday night talking about why I'm an alcoholic. So I did a lot of drinking and it just turned to other things. And You know, none of it worked out for me. Got me in a lot of trouble. I made a lot of stupid decisions. Hurt a lot of people. I hurt myself too. I figured out after the fact because in the midst of it, I didn't really care what I did to myself. I thought I cared about what I did to other people, but I really didn't when I looked at it. And, you know, really nothing good came out of drinking for me. I went to like detoxes at first for, you know, for like, just to, you know, like shut everyone up. You know, it was just like a thing. It was just like a thing to check off the list. Like, oh, I went to a detox. All right, that's good. I'll be good for a couple months. You know, and that was like okay with me. I was like fine with that. And, you know, none of my friends were really doing any of that. I mean, they were doing the same things I was, but they weren't like going to detoxes and, you know, stuff like that. And at the time, I really didn't think it mattered. I just, you know, I figured like it was like going on vacation and it didn't really matter, to me at least. I knew I had a problem with drinking from the day I started. Actually, I shouldn't say that. I didn't really know until I looked back at it, but, you know, there was always something different about when I drank. You know, once I started doing anything, drugs, drinking, it was like, it was completely revolved around that. So we drank and do an activity, and the activity was out the window. It didn't matter. It was just about the drinking and the drugs. That's just how it was for me. And when I look at that now, it's just like, you know, it all makes sense. I really did have a problem. You know, it controlled my life. Everything I did revolved around it. I'd go to work to make money to support my habits. You know, I'd hang out with certain people where I knew I could do certain things. It really just controlled my life, and I really didn't care. I really just thought that was like how we were supposed to live. I didn't really believe in like people being actually happy. I didn't think anything was fun. I had no interest in anything. I had no motivation to do anything. Didn't like sports, didn't like anything, just like drinking and doing drugs. And that I was completely okay with that. It was like my niche. It was like what I liked to do. It was what I was good at. And then finally, I went to a detox and you know, I was there for 2 weeks and it sucked. And I was working for my brother at the time, and he said the only way I was coming back to work for him was if I went to a halfway house and like all that stuff. And I was just like, oh, I don't want to lose my job. So whatever, fine, I'll try it. I'll just figure out a way out of it when the time comes. And you know, I went to a holding because there was no available rooms in like halfway houses. And you know, that was it was a horrible place. Like, not a horrible place, I shouldn't say that, it was the worst place, but it was pretty bad. It was sucked, it was no fun. You were inside all the time, it sucked. It was like, just sucked, but, you know, I try not to complain about things like all the time, that's why I do stuff like that, but yeah, it sucked. But anyway, you know, it really saved my life, it helped me a lot. I saw a lot of people in there, and even though they were just like, you know, they left and faded out and did their thing. I learned a lot from everybody. I learn a lot from everybody I come across, no matter what. I always, that's one thing I've learned from AA. I learned to actually like listen to what people are saying, not just like think about what I'm gonna say before they're done talking. I used to do that all the time. And you know, being in there, it was like great. And when I got out, I got a sponsor. I joined a group and I went to meetings. That's what I did immediately. That's what I always heard. And that worked for me. It might not work for everyone, but it worked for me. I know other people that stay sober different ways, but it worked for me. Got a sponsor, started working the steps, went to meetings. Kids in my halfway houses, they wanted to do, you know, they'd go out, do different stuff. They'd go to meetings I went to meetings because, you know, there was recovery there. There was people talking about how to get sober, not, you know, who had the best clothes and cars and all that stuff. And, you know, I'm still sober now, which, you know, it makes my family happy, but more importantly, it makes me happy. And I didn't care about that before. And that's one gift AA gave me, too. I actually care about myself. I actually care about my well-being today. And by getting a sponsor, joining a home group, you know, taking suggestions from people, even though I don't like them, and trying to do the right thing every day, it's kept me sober because it keeps me with a clean conscience. And, it's just great. I really love AA. I shouldn't say that I like go to meetings as much as I should anymore. I definitely should like go every day, but I don't. because life caught up to me. I got a little bit of time and I started taking nights off, and I see now working at it that I definitely should start going to more meetings, and just speaking at this meeting shows me that. That's another reason why I love AA, because I'm always learning something new. It's one of those things where it's like I come into a meeting and it doesn't matter if you have a minute sober, a day sober, or like 30 years sober. No matter what you say, I can always learn something from it. I try to come in with the mentality that I know nothing, because it's really helped me, and I've learned a lot from it. I was like really happy to be asked to speak at this meeting. One of my good friends asked me to speak, and that's another thing too. I remember when I was drinking, when people would call me, I'd always like either put the phone on silent, put the phone under a pillow, put the phone on the other side of the room, because I didn't want to answer unless I was like drunk, or it felt like I wanted to talk, because I never wanted to talk to anybody. But now, when my phone rings, regardless of who it is and regardless if I want to answer or not, I answer. At first it's like, eh, but then I answer, and it's just one of those things. Another thing that AA has taught me, like if I'm uncomfortable, I'm probably in the right place, like right now. I just try to like take suggestions, and I just try to always be honest. Being honest is a huge one. Ever since I've really been honest, I used to lie about everything. I won't go into it, but I just used to lie about everything. Like what color my shoes, just like anything. I don't even know why. It was like a habit. It was just like breathing. I would just like if somebody asked me a question, I'd lie. For no reason. It didn't matter why. I just did it. And so now I try to like think about what I say, and that's all gifts from AA. It really is. It's nothing else, because I'm like I work with guys that are a lot older than me, and I'm like somewhat young. I'm pretty young, but even they say sometimes, which is like a compliment to me, is you act mature for your age. It's really because of this stuff, and it's just because like this like program book and suggestions from other people have like actually taught me how to be like a caring, genuine person, and like be like a person of my word, if that makes any sense. Just like always try to be there for people. If I give you my number, like I'll always answer the phone. I always want to talk to people. I'll always be helpful to you, because that's what I got when I got in. Once I found a home group and I started actually reaching out to people, which I hated doing. I never wanted to ask a guy to be my sponsor. That was the worst thing in the world. It really was. So if you're struggling with that, definitely go do it and just be like, hey, will you be my sponsor? That's all you got to say. 1, 2, 3, go. That's what I would do. Because I remember when I did it, I was like, not doing that. I feel like everyone has the same feeling. If you're a guy or whatever, you probably have the same feeling. It's a hard thing to do. But it was the best thing I ever did. It really helped me a lot. I still call him every day. That's another thing. I still call him every day. I call him at the same time every day, even though I don't want him. Because I know I'm going to say something to him that he's going to say I probably shouldn't do. And then I'm going to be like, oh, man. And then I do it anyway. But I still call him, and I tell him that I'm probably going to do it anyway. And and he's like, well, I think you should. It goes back and forth, it's like a tug of war. But, having him there and still calling him, being honest with him, has really helped me stay sober. So I suggest if you're new or if you're whatever, get a sponsor, join a group, come to meetings. That's all I really get to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Pat. Our next 10-minute speaker is Jane T.
Hi. Hi, I'm Jane. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey.
I'm really nervous. this is my home group, and has been for about 6 months, and I just celebrated a year here last week. Um, Yeah, thank you so much for asking me to speak. Actually, it's kind of funny. She asked me to speak after, at the break at BYP, right after I had celebrated, and I was like, wow, I must have done a really good job speaking. And then I immediately was like so resentful at myself for my ego, and I had to go home and write out a resentment to myself. But that's what happened. So anyway, I initially started coming to AA about 3.5 years ago after an interesting summer in Spain, where I put myself in a lot of really dangerous situations and did a lot of drinking and was extremely belligerent and inconsiderate of a lot of people. And I had a lie, like the previous speaker, just lied impulsively about everything since I was a small child. I always like had to one-up people's stories with fake stories, and like I was just a liar. And one of the stories I told myself is that I was such a lady, and so I couldn't let anybody, even these like other study abroad students in Spain, see what I was doing. And so, and like how I was drinking. And so what I typically did was I would just say, I don't like having to hold my cell phone while I'm dancing. Can you put my cell phone in your purse? And then they had no way of getting in touch with me and I could disappear. And they wouldn't see me again until class or whatever. And it didn't ever occur to me that was probably not the most considerate thing to do. Or that anybody cared about me. And so, anyway, I thought that I was drinking every day because I was in Spain and it was a cultural thing. And I was really surprised when I got back to the US and I was still drinking every day. And I was 21 at the time. And fast forward just like a few months, I was back in school and midterms were coming up, and I'd actually been in a different program for a while and had read the Big Book and had sponsored people using the Big Book. And so I knew more about alcoholism than the average, like, brand new drinking alcoholic of a few months. And so my drinking was kind of like ruined before I ever really got started. thanks. And so there was one day when I really needed to study, and I thought like I had, in just such a short span of time, since this was probably, actually I know exactly when it was September 27th, 2013, since I had turned 21 that January, because I didn't really start drinking until I was 21, because there's a lot of alcoholism in my family, wanted to play it safe, I had to study, and I thought like, I'm not gonna go buy alcohol tonight. And I got on my bike and I biked over to this liquor store on Mass Ave and I bought alcohol and I took it home and I was like, oh no, I know what this is. And then I was like, oh, here's the real test. And I've been trying to stop pretty much since I started. Like I am, like there's, my mom has 4 siblings. 2 of them have been in recovery for decades. 2 of them are in really bad shape and have been in and out of detoxes and psych wards for a really long time. And so I have a pretty good compare-contrast of what treated alcoholism and untreated alcoholism look like from my family. And so I prayed for the obsession to be lifted in my dorm room, and it was, and my reaction was not, oh, thank God. It was, oh no, that means I'm an alcoholic. And so I started coming to meetings. And but I wasn't totally convinced, honestly. I wasn't totally convinced until a year ago when my life started getting good at one point. I went through the steps, kind of. and I made some amends. Not all of them, and I got a grant and I went to Mexico to do research, and I went to one meeting, didn't like it, and decided to write off all of AA and all of Mexico. And so I didn't have a sponsor, and I wasn't going to meetings, and you can guess how that story ended. And so when I was back here last January for a wedding, I asked somebody here to sponsor me, Kara. And fortunately, she said yes, and I made it really impossible for her to sponsor me for a few months by not calling her. but drank alcohol while I was there, and I was going to English-speaking AA meetings at this point in Mexico with a bunch of American expats, and I was lying to them. I was like, yeah, I still have 2.5 years, da-da-da-da. I got back. When I got back here last April, I started being honest. And I went back to my old home group that I still go to pretty frequently, Morning Glories in Cambridge. And I told them, and that was really humbling. And one of the things that I did is, like, at first I had a lot of trouble calling Kara every day, and then I started calling her a little bit more often, but I would just, like, tell her really superficial things. And I had no concept of what it was like to let another human being, like, actually see me. And I remember having a conversation. I remember exactly where I was. I was in California, and I was on my cell phone walking my parents' dog. And I remember having a conversation with her sometime last summer about this. And it was, and I like cried, and she told me, you know, I'd be honored to sponsor you, but right now what we're doing is in sponsorship. And that was such a important moment for me. And there's been a couple key moments like that. Another one was I started working on amends, and I was like little by little making a couple amends here and there. I had made like one that I never expected to be able to make so soon. That was really like a game changer for me. But I hadn't become willing to make amends to everybody on my step list yet. And I still haven't made amends to everybody I owe amends to. But there was like a moment when I actually became willing to make amends to all those people. And that was really key also. And so like I went back to Mexico, I made something like, I don't know, like 14 amends in a week and a half or something. And realized like, I like leave a trail of wreckage behind me when my ego is running the show. And even when I'm trying to be good, I'm like a creator of confusion. And one of the things that's been so interesting for me in doing the ninth step is realizing that there are things that I owe amends for that I didn't think I owed amends for, and then there are also things that I thought I owed amends for and I thought I was responsible for that I wasn't. And so it's like, those are two pieces of it that have been really, I've learned a lot from. And also, I had heard somebody say at a meeting, I have 1 minute left. I heard somebody say at a meeting, a really long time, I can't say that long, but I've been coming to meetings 3 years, but a really long time ago, in the olden days, before the internet, somebody said, like, ego deflation is just fine for white Protestant males, and I, like, hung on to that. I was like, yeah, but turns out, like, I really needed my ego to be deflated really badly. And I like I thought my problem was like, no, my ego is like too deflated. I think I'm the worst. But all I thought about was how I was the worst. And so that's ego. And I'm like amazed that I'm even keeled. I was never, ever, ever even keeled. And anyway, thank you. That's all.
Beacon Group. If you are visiting from out of town, or if you are here for the first time tonight, we are delighted you are here. We will now object to 7-2, which states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Although there are no dues or fees for AA membership, a $2 donation is recommended so that AA can remain self-supporting. While the basket is being passed, please keep in mind that our rent is $600 per month. There are weeks when we do not meet the minimum amount needed to support this group. Please give what you can to the treasurer's report on the board or ask our treasurer, Maria, after the meeting if you have any questions. Thanks in advance for your generosity. We have AA literature available on the table in the back. If you don't have the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, please don't leave here tonight without one. It sells for $9.50. If you haven't bought one for a newcomer lately, I strongly encourage you to do so. We also have meeting directories available. These are free. Please visit our website, beacongroupaa.com, where you can sign up for membership in our group, join our email list, view announcements, listen to past speakers, view our commitment calendar, sign up for the convention and festivities, and more. If you have any questions, you may see Sarah H. after the meeting. Sponsorship is a cornerstone of AA's 12-step recovery program. If you are a newcomer and you don't have a sponsor, we strongly suggest you get one. Please see Christine or Jason after the meeting. They will be stationed by the door. If you would like to be a sponsor, you may speak to them as well. We have 3 ongoing monthly commitments. On the second Friday of the month, March 10th, we are going to South Bay House of Corrections. It is a 7 p.m. arrival at the facility. Remember, only 5 people can go at a time, so please be sure to let Amanda or Manish know if you would like to go. On the second Tuesday of the month, March 14th at 7 p.m., we'll be going to the Women's Renewal Center at Dimmick in Roxbury. Please see Ken or Victoria if you would like to go. Everyone is welcome on that commitment. On the third Tuesday of the month, March 21st at 7 p.m., we'll be going to Whitten Hospital in Everett. Please see Kelly or Evan if you would like to go. Everyone is welcome on that commitment as well. Before I turn the meeting back over to our leader, please remember there is no smoking on church property. If you smoke or vape, we ask that you only do so on the public sidewalks away from the church entrances, either on Harvard or Marion Streets. There's a receptacle provided for butts, and we appreciate smokers using this. Now I will turn the meeting back over to Allie.
AA also has a set of traditions which apply to the group in much the same manner that the 12 steps apply to the individual. Tonight, James has been asked to read the 12 traditions.
James, an alcoholic.
Hi, James.
The 12 traditions. One our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends on AA unity. 2, for our group purpose, there are but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience, our leaders, and our but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4, each group should be anonymous except in matters affecting other groups of A or AA as a whole. 5, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9, AA as as such ought never to be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the AA name ought to never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all AA traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. James Lovell.
Just a reminder as we're winding down here, please remember to dump your coffee into the orange bucket or in the sink in the kitchen before you throw it away, because otherwise it's splashing on the ground and against the walls, and the church is going to ask us to not have coffee here anymore. So please dump it in the orange bucket or in the sink. Tonight, our main speaker is John.
This will work. I'm probably going to be leaning down on this in a minute anyway. Hi, everybody. I'm John. I'm an alcoholic and an addict. Thank you, Jen and Mike, for inviting me here tonight. And for those of you who were at Back Bay Steps this morning, I apologize. This will be a little bit of a repeat. I was not planning on... I told Mike a month ago I'd share tonight. And it was good for me because I hadn't told my story in a half a year probably. And I said, okay, that's good. I can... go to this, I've been to this meeting in 2 years, I guess, and I went to a meeting Sunday, and I walked in Hingham men's meeting, Sunday night. As I walked in, they said, we need a speaker. Okay, I get to warm up for Thursday. So I spoke at that, and then I left Back Bay Steps on Tuesday, and Karen ran out and said, I need a speaker for Thursday morning, would you mind? I said, okay. So I'm a little jumbled up, I don't know where to begin, and you'd think I'd be well prepared for this. When in doubt, tell the truth, you know, and that's what I'm gonna try to do tonight. And it was great to hear Pat and Jane, congratulations. A couple of themes that came up immediately for me, and it's important for me to recognize this when I go to AA meetings, is that humility and honesty are synonymous, and you can't have one without the other, and I've learned that in here. And it's real important, it's real difficult. My mentor in AA 27 years ago, Kay, she said, John, it's impossible for the alcoholic to be honest with himself. And that's why we have this fellowship, and it's a therapy of words, and we share, and we get humble the day we say, I'm an alcoholic. That's a pretty humiliating thing to say. I knew I was years before I said it. It took me a while to eventually say it. And it was the most honest thing I could say to another human being. It's changed my life. That was 27 years ago. I'd like to tell you I've been sober since then. I haven't been. My sobriety date is October 20th, 2002. My first sobriety date was November 11th, 1989. I was 31 years old. And I went to an AA meeting. I didn't know what the hell was going on. I was terrified. And I loved it. I loved it from the beginning. And then I have another sobriety date. I went out after 6 months, I went out for a month. A little more research. Wasn't sure I belonged here. Life got good quick. I was getting up in the morning. I'm going to work. Three meetings a week turned into one a week, turned into one every 2 weeks, turned into, I got it. I was playing center field, for anybody who played any baseball, that's what center fielders do or shortstops do. They call everybody off. I got it. And that's what happens when you don't share, or if you're not honest. And it's real hard to be honest. It's impossible for me to be honest with myself because I'll rationalize and justify anything I want to hear. You know, we'll talk about the fifth step in a minute, but that's why the fifth step was written the way it is. Admit it to God, to ourselves, no problem. No problem. And another human being? I don't think so. I don't think so. Let me spend a little more time with myself and with God, and I'll figure out what to tell the other human being. And that's why it's the fifth step and not the first step. It takes a while to get there. So I came back after a month, and I put about a year and a half together, and the same thing happened. I was terrified to speak. I was terrified to open up. I didn't know how to trust. I didn't know how to share. I just went to more meetings. And I found the early bird in South Boston in the spring of 1990 because I found it was impossible for me to get up in the morning and go through the day and not obsess about the drink. And so to intercept that, someone recommended, why don't you go to the 7:30 meeting and maybe you'll get some information that will get you to the evening meeting. Two meetings a day, that's kind of excessive, don't you think? Well, some are sicker than others, and you might be one of those. So that worked for about 18 months, and the same thing happened. I changed jobs, things went great, and I stopped going to meetings. And then I forgot I was an alcoholic, and I picked up, and now I was out there for about 3 months. My wife, who just had our fifth child, had enough of that, threw me out of the house. Kids were scared, she was scared, I was scared, but didn't let anybody know it. And I moved in on my father's couch for 30 days, bad behavior, and started going to two or three meetings a day because I didn't know what else to do with myself, and I got a good, solid foundation, and I stayed sober for another 2.5 years. And then, I forget the occurrence, I think it was a Christmas party. I was drinking soda water, and I reached down and I picked up a soda water, but it wasn't soda water. And after half a sip, I knew it wasn't soda water, but I didn't stop. And I said, well, this must be God's will. That's where my brain was. That's how sick I was, you know, I was spiritually sick. And I didn't know it, because I was checking the box with AA meetings. I was doing 6-7 meetings a week, checked the box. But God saw to it to make me drink that night, and didn't tell anybody. Just had that one drink, pretended it didn't happen, went to AA for a couple of days, still didn't tell anybody, because I didn't want to change that sobriety day, you know, it's my report card. You know, I wanted to get that 2-year medallion and maybe get to 3, and after about 2 weeks, it just owned me. I couldn't stop thinking about it. That's alcoholism. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous has prevented me from taking the first drink, but nothing is going to prevent me from taking the second. Nothing. AA might stop me from the first, but nothing will stop me from the second. That's been my experience. So I went out of the house again on my father's couch. This time it's 2 months. Kids are a little older now. They're getting a little more upset. They know what's going on. And I've got shame, and I've got guilt, and I'm afraid to go back to AA. And I'm still not talking at meetings. I'm going to speak. I'm doing everything I can to avoid talking to people and put my hand up. I was terrified. And I was afraid of just being judged, you know. And if you're new and you're in this room, try to talk to somebody. I wish, I probably heard that, but I didn't want to hear it, so I didn't listen. But it is helpful to open up with someone. This is a fellowship of sponsorship. And it's really critical that we latch onto somebody. At least it was for me, and I was afraid to do that because I didn't know how to get close to anyone. And I didn't know where to begin once I got there. How's it going? Great. 30 days, 6 months, 9 months, I'm doing great. Yeah, you are. You go to a lot of meetings. Must be. Yeah, things are great. And I go right to my work and my home and my kids and stay away from me. And so in 97, my mother was going through her last days from this disease. She died at 61. She's the oldest of 6. Her mother died at 58 from this disease. Her younger sister at 43 from this disease. Another younger sister at 56 from this disease. And no one talked about it. Cancer. Cancer. Yeah, they all had cancer. Cancer of the liver. And it's an ugly way to go out. And that's the home I grew up in. It was always awkward, a lot of fear, doubt, insecurity. What happens here stays here, and forget it happened. And, you know, it was like, my life was like elementary school. You put stuff up on the chalkboard, and when you finish, you erase it, pretend it didn't happen. if you didn't like the result. And that's the way I grew up, and that's the way I lived my life for a long time. Just pretend that didn't happen. One day at a time, I had no trouble with it. I lived my life one day at a time my whole life. I never wanted to look back. So I came back in after a year, and I got sober in October of 98. And my friend Harry J. from the downtown meeting said, "John, you've been around here for a while. Why don't you put your hand up at every third meeting? Speak twice a week. Own your program. Own your recovery. Get a sponsor. Do the steps." And I'd go to these meetings, these lunchtime meetings, and Harry would be over there, and he'd be looking at me, and I'd put my hand up, and I'd stammer, and I'd worry about what people thought of me while I was speaking, and then I'd be thinking about it all afternoon, what an idiot. But it kept me sober, and it got me plugged in, and I felt like I belonged. And then I started going to step meetings, and I was going to big book meetings, and I was going to three meetings a day for a while, because the marriage was also falling apart. I mean, my wife was, she had had it, but she was stuck. I had her hostage. I was working. She had five kids, two in college, three in high school now, and she wasn't going anywhere. And you know, we loved each other, but we didn't like each other very much after this. And we'd go weeks without talking to each other, which is a very easy thing to do with five kids in the house, believe it or not. If anybody grew up in a big home, the parents are coming and going. But I wasn't happy. She wasn't happy. I was busy with AA, and I was busy with work, and life was moving on, and I wasn't talking about what I was unhappy about, and I didn't know how to verbalize it. And that went on for about 35 months, and work was going great. And I found myself on a business trip to South Korea. I had never been out of the country before. I'm 43 years old. And where was I going? I had five kids and no money. Disney World was, that was an event. So I found myself on a business trip to South Korea. And on the second night, they didn't like the fact that Mr. John wasn't drinking. You know, the drinking culture was part of the business culture after dinner. And I was like, the spotlight was on me. The Americans in, you got all these Korean businessmen were negotiating deals, this transaction, and it was going well. And they wanted to celebrate, and I didn't want any part of it. And I'd go to the bathroom and just leave. "Where'd you go last night?" And so the second night, they grabbed me. "Are you coming with us?" So the president of the company flew in, and we shook hands on this deal. We consummated the transaction, which meant I had to go back there every month for the next indefinitely. And he looked at me and he said, "I understand you don't drink." I said, "No, I don't." He goes, "Why, you're Irish." He said, "We're the Irish of the Orient." I said, "What does that mean?" He said, "We like to drink, sing songs, and fight." I said, "And if you're from Boston and you're from Irish, you must be like me." He said, "You came here for one reason." I said, "What's that?" He said, "The 50,000 men who died so that we could do business together." And he's crying, he's got the necktie around his head, and he's got two shot glasses in his hand. And I said, "Well, all right, it was a pretty big war here. It was a long time ago. I could probably do one shot, not tell anybody." So I did one shot, and then I woke up the next morning with the mini bar open, making myself a screwdriver so I could get the hangover from the 20 shots I did the night before. I was like, "Oh boy, here we go." And I akin it to taking the chairlift up to the top of a mountain and throwing the poles off. I just went down the slope for the next 18 months, and it was bad. It was bad. It was really bad. As soon as I got home from that trip, my wife turned around and she knew right away. So, back to my father's couch. And I was kind of okay with it now because I knew what was happening. I knew I was going to be going back to Korea every month. I knew I couldn't go there and not drink. I tried not to drink while I was in the States, but I was bouncing back and forth to New York on this transaction. And I would, every week, and I was going by myself. Not good. And I was going to Korea. I mean, minibars I became an expert at, and nips, pints, the whole thing, and I say it every time, social drinkers don't drink nips. Social drinkers don't buy pints. Social drinkers don't walk into package stores at 8 a.m. and buy pints on their way to work. That's just not like normal behavior. Alcoholics do that. And I was getting in line. I could tell you every package store, this was 14 and a half years ago, but I could tell you every package store inside of Route 128 that's open at 8 o'clock. Because God forbid if the guy knows that I was here yesterday and 2 days ago, and so I had to move it around a lot. And Cleveland Circle, Tremont Street, South End, South Boston on P Street, there's one in Dorchester at Ashmont Station, Cleveland Circle. I mean, it was unbelievable. Washington Street, Brookline, 8 a.m. I knew where to get my Absolute. And then I knew where to get cocaine. And then I knew how to take the day off and lie to everybody where I was. And I was absolutely on fire. I ended up having, that relapse lasted 15 months. My wife filed for divorce. The kids stopped talking to me. I hung on to the job. And the funny thing is, not funny, but the irony is, I had maybe 10 years of sobriety in that 12-year period. And every time I picked up, I went out longer. And it was harder to come back. It just, and I'm terrified. That's why I have to remind myself, like, I am an alcoholic. I will live the rest of my life an alcoholic. I have a pilot light. It's called alcoholism. It won't go out. And all I have to do to ignite that fire is add booze to it. And it's over. It is over. I'm lucky I'm here. I also love the fact that I'm in AA. I can't say that I'm grateful I'm an alcoholic. No, that would be a lie. I am grateful I'm an alcoholic in recovery. You see, because I've got a dad who's 88. He hasn't, I'll bet he's had a drink every day of his life since he was 18. Never missed a day of work. I call him Mr. Magoo. He just, like, he's clueless. Like, but his life has become unmanageable because of booze. He made bad decisions financially. He got himself into some jams financially. He's never recovered from it. His life was really small by the time he was 50 in terms of his network of friends. He skims the surface. He's a great guy, but he just can't. I mean, I know more about people whose last names I don't know than my own family members just by going to meetings. And that's an unbelievable gift. Like, that's living life, you know? And he's had a great life, he thinks. You know, I don't want to tell him otherwise, you know? But it's like, geez, you know? I mean, I probably met 500 people last year, you know? And 500 the year before that, who I didn't know before that. And on it goes. And just the enrichment and the nourishment that we get out of this program. I'm a grateful, grateful guy. And AA has changed my life. Everything, I've got a beautiful wife I met in this program, even though I left a beautiful wife behind because I absolutely destroyed that marriage with my childish, selfish, immature behavior. You know, I was 18. I had no business being a husband and a dad to these five little kids because all I thought about when I was home is, when am I going to get out of here? There was no emotional capital left for me to invest in my own family because all I thought about was drinking and drugging. And, you know, that was a painful step. So part of the solution, let's talk about the solution. I came back in October of 2002, and I was about 90 days sober, and I ran into this guy that I used to avoid. He was way too serious. He went to a lot of meetings. He talked about the steps all the time. He talked about sponsorship. And I'm such a people pleaser. I felt if I got near him, he'd ask me if I wanted him to be my sponsor, which he would have done. And so I stayed away from him for 10 years. And he cornered me after a step meeting. And he said, why don't you get with the program? And this is like a really kind, nice man, you know. And he was stern. I took offense to that comment. What do you mean? I got 90 days again. He said, this is a 12-step program. And he said, it's a fellowship of sponsorship. And the job of a sponsor is to take an individual through the steps. That's the primary job of a sponsor. That's how the program started in 1935. And he said, let me take you through the steps. Have you ever done it? I'm like, oh yeah, I read the steps all the time. Have you ever done them? Not really. Have you ever done it with another man? I said, no. And he said, what you ought to do is, well, let's go through it in the big book. And that day we did 1, 2, and 3 out of the big book. And he said, why don't we set up an appointment for a 4-step
Oh boy, I don't want to do that. The last confession I had at the church didn't go too well. When was that? 25 years ago. So he took me through the four step, the way it's laid out in the big book, column A, column B, column C. He said, listen, don't be afraid of it. It's not a confession. You're just going to make a list of all the people that pissed you off from your earliest memory. And we sat down, and he tricked me on this one, because I was, what about the fifth step? Don't worry about that. Let's do the fourth step. And we sat down at a table, and he had the pen, and he asked me questions. Okay, earliest memory, mother, father, teacher, coach, friends, all the people that I remember that irritated me, where if I saw him on the street, my blood would boil, or I'd walk across the other side. And I got through that in about an hour and a half, and he said, okay, what did they do to make you feel that way? And what was the byproduct of that? Fear, 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 shame, ego, fear. Fear, 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 anger, fear. And here's a guy who never thought, every time someone talked about fear at a meeting, I said, what are they talking about? I had no idea, you know. I get the anger piece, I get the resentment piece, which is basically just a byproduct of fear, or ego, or selfishness. They're all connected, he explained to me. And we talked about it. And he said, what's your role in this? What's your part in some of this? So we finished that 3-4 hours later. I said, when do we do the fifth step? He said, you just did. You did 4 and 5 today. That was cool. Okay, I felt better. I didn't have the white light, but I did feel better. I felt like I was a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. 13 years into this program, I was like, wow, I'm actually doing this now. I own this. I'm gonna keep this. And half the people on that four-step list wound up on my eight-step amends list. And I didn't have the big turnaround, the personal turnaround, until I did that. I had to, my ex-wife and my kids didn't want any part of it. And they didn't trust me. And so the deal I made with them was, I was seeing a therapist once every 2 weeks, and he said, have them come in here, and I'll let them ask you any question they want. Tell them they can ask you anything and you will answer it truthfully. That's going to save your life and it's going to save theirs. I don't really want to do that. He said, no, I think it'd be a real good idea if you did that. And so they came in, my ex didn't, but my kids did. And they asked me everything, that where was I, what happened at this thing, what were you doing there? And I told them, and it wasn't pretty. It wasn't pretty. Like, the emperor had no clothes at the end of this 2-hour meeting. But it was, that's what's called a thorough ninth step. I explained what I did. I apologized for my behavior. I explained why it won't happen again. And there's a living amends thereafter. And I have a great relationship with my kids today. It took a while. It took a little while. But one of them works for me. The others are all part of my life. I talk to all of them. They're 26 to 36 now. And when I came in, there were only 4 of them, not 5. So it's been a long road. I did the best I could. I think they believe that. I love them unconditionally. They definitely believe that. And that's the most important thing in my life. And I also know that what's more important than that is this program. Without this program, I have nothing. I don't have a job. I don't have myself. I don't have my family. So if you're struggling and you're new and you're trying to figure it all out, there's a real, there's a treasure in this program. It's called the Big Book, right here. This book, if anybody, those who have read it, it was written by a few people who were 2 years sober, and it hasn't changed much in 85 years because it works. And the only explanation I have for that, it's like God's hand at work. For two guys to sit down and start it, and then a couple other 100 people maybe participating before it got published, is God's hands at work, because it has saved millions of lives, and there's a lot of great information in there. And I guess I'll wrap it up with this, because I had trouble finding the God of my understanding. I was brought up Irish Catholic, and I had this punishing, guilt-ridden relationship with God growing up, where I thought he existed, but he wasn't for me. And in Bill's story, he writes about his newfound friend, capital F, It's the only time friend is capitalized in the book. His newfound friend is his higher power, because Bill didn't believe in God at all when he started. And that's the way I look at my God today. He's my best friend. He's with me all the time. But I didn't know how to connect with him. And that's why, and it says in chapter 4, when my sponsor and I got there, we agnostics. I said, no, we can skip this chapter. I'm not an agnostic. He said, no, we're going to read everything. And on page 45, which is the second page of chapter 4, we agnostics, it says, we absolutely must find a power greater than ourselves to restore us to sanity if we have any chance. We must find a power greater than ourselves. And the next line it says, and that's what this book is about. We find a power greater than ourselves. And that's by doing these steps one day at a time. So don't drink, go to meetings, ask for help, find your higher power, and try to enjoy your life rather than endure it. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Now we have Hillary and Corey for festivities.
Corey, alcoholic.
Hi, Corey.
Hillary, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Corey.
Okay, welcome to the Beacon Group. This group hosts fellowship afterwards. We do fellowship at Lee's Burgers immediately after the meeting, which is down on the, it's two blocks from here. What's this on? And we will meet out front to go to that afterwards. This group also hosts a big book meeting called Beacon by the Book. This is on Monday nights from 8 to 9 at the Boston Graduate School of Psychoanalysis, which is at 1581 Beacon Street. All are welcome to attend. A special note, you should get there about 5 minutes early to get a seat, but if you get there too early, we get in trouble, so don't show up before 7:30. And we don't have any anniversary watches this week, but we do have a couple of events going on, entertainment events that this group is putting on.
So we have Boston Bid for Icky Paws putting on Snowy Paw, which is a big ski weekend up in Maine from March 17th to the 19th. We'll have a flyer over on board where you can talk to Ashley about that after the meeting. The Rhode Island 41st State Convention is happening March 24th to the 26th in Newport, Rhode Island. There's more information on this flyer. It's going to be over there also, or you can go to rhodeisland-a.org. You can download it there. And then the Beacon Group, that's what we're putting on, is we're doing rock climbing. So we're all going to go out on March 25th, 10 a.m., to Boston Rock Climb in Woburn. And we're going to be sending out an email about that this week to the email list. And we'll have flyers too, and there'll be more info about sort of coordinating rides and like what that'll look like. So,
ski trip. Do you have a ski trip? Ski trip info?
Yep. All right, we're all set.
Yep. Hey, guys, my name is Lana. I'm an alcoholic, and I serve this group as your general service representative. So I just wanted a couple of announcements. I attended NARASA last weekend. It's a service assembly, and we discuss conference agenda items. And they give us a little background information. So two weeks from now, two Thursdays from now, on the third Thursday of every month, we have our steering committee, which has been announced, is open to all to come and observe. And that would be a great week for you guys to join. Please, please, if you are group members, or if you just want to learn, but I need your feedback. So if I'm going to vote on behalf, and there's no official vote, but if I'm going to tell our delegate what our group thinks, then I need to know what our group thinks. So, you know, and there's some really interesting agenda items, like things like a LinkedIn page, an official LinkedIn page for Alcoholics Anonymous. I just attended a cluster meeting where we were discussing it, and especially some of the younger people know a lot more about technology and things, you know, anonymity and things like that, and I honestly don't. So, I mean, I'm not that I'm not young, but I can really use your feedback, and so I can speak on behalf of the group. So please come to the steering committee meeting in 2 weeks, and Let me talk to you about those agenda items so that I can hear your voice. I can give your voice to our delegate. The delegate can give your voice to General Service Conference. And the upside down triangle remains in place. Otherwise, it's just my voice. So I'll let you know that. So there's that. And then I just wanted to make one quick, really exciting announcement from GSO. So our New England Regional Trustee told us about the final budget from GSO this year. So we were projected to end the year at negative 29,000. So we were supposed to have a deficit. And we actually ended, Albert, in his words, he said that they asked they called up the fellowship and the fellowship answered that call. So we ended up ending at positive $1,464,624. And so we can finally start digging ourselves out of some of the, I can talk to you more about that in depth, that stuff. But it's a really exciting thing because that money is what makes 12-step work possible. You know, if you've ever seen a pamphlet in Braille or something, that's where that money goes. Translating literature, a big book, you know, we sometimes can take it for granted that everything's in our language. So that's really exciting news. And if you have any more questions, please come talk to me or the alternate GSR, Anna, I don't know where she is. Anna, stand up.
Where is she?
And now, Catherine and Carol for Chips.